morning, everybody. My name is John Matlock, Director of External Relations and Outreach here at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to everybody online as well. You're joining us here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. This lecture series is brought to you by KPMG. We'd like to thank KPMG for their support in bringing the festival to you, and in particular, the lectures here from the Theatre of Ideas. Also to TVO, our presenting media partner, who are helping us out with all of these great technologies and Stream the World for bringing you the vivid pictures online at home. Before we begin the lecture, I would like to remind everybody in the theatre to turn off your Blackberries and other devices. Those of you at home, you may wish to email your friends and family right now that the presentation is about to begin. In terms of questions, those of you at home, you can submit your questions on the blogs that you'll see on the different sites, and they'll be forwarded here in theater to Jennifer Dodd, who will relay them on your behalf. For those of you in the building, we'll be providing a microphone just down here near the podium, and we'll ask you to come down the stairs on this side at the end of the lecture to speak directly into the mic and ask Damien any questions that you like. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Damien Pope. He is the Senior Manager of Scientific Outreach here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. In this role, he combines his background as a researcher in quantum information theory and quantum foundations with his passion for communicating scientific ideas. Today, Damien is going to guide us through the mysterious world of quantum physics in the next 60 minutes. Damien, the clock is running.
Thanks for that introduction, John. So this talk came about when I was talking to a friend of mine a number of years ago, and I told him, well, I'm thinking about writing a popular book on quantum physics. And he said, a book? I don't have time to read a book. Who has time to read a book? So that kind of got me thinking, well, you know, what can I pack into an hour? So this kind of led to this talk. And I should say, this is intended to be a very gentle, basic introduction for people that really have no kind of background or experience with quantum physics. I was kind of dismayed when I found out recently that actually this slot is only 55 minutes, not 60 minutes. So a little bit of false advertising there, but I'll see how I can go. So I guess the first question is, what is quantum physics? What I'd like you to do is to think about everything that you see around you now. Think about and what it's made up of. And the seat that you're sitting on, your clothes, your hair, the roof here, if you go outside, the clouds, the sun, you know, if you're looking out at night, the stars, everything you can see is made up of atoms. And they're made up of even smaller, tiny particles, subatomic objects, protons, neutrons, and electrons. And what quantum physics is really, it's kind of the physics or the laws of really how these tiny particles really move around and collide or otherwise interact with each other. So to give you kind of an idea of the scale, these subatomic particles, these subatomic objects, they're ridiculously small. So an atom is around about, I think a grain of sand is about the smallest thing you can see with the naked eye. And so an atom is around about a million times smaller than that. That's kind of hard to get your head around. It's almost impossible too. So much so, I've actually brought in a grain of sand, and I have it here. Kind of, you probably can't see it, but I'm just going to pass it around. And if you could just take that, please. So, I kind of lost it there. I really do want to do this genuinely. I really do have something here. Okay, so just pass it around, and the last person that gets, if they could just hand it back at the end there. Great, okay. So neutrons and protons and electrons are even smaller than that. So we're talking about something very, very tiny. And really it's how these kind of particles move around and collide with each other. So that's quantum physics. So why the heck should you care about quantum physics? Well, I'll give you some reasons. For many people, I think it would be the single greatest scientific advance in our understanding of the universe, understanding of the world around us. And it describes most of the universe, pretty much everything except for gravity, at least as far as we know, as far as we've been able to do experiments. So in terms of kind of the scope and breadth of quantum physics, it's just unprecedented. It describes why, you know, stars in these distant galaxies shine, fundamentally why plants grow from seeds up to big trees or flowers, why, you know, two chemicals mix together and bond together in the way that they do. So it's incredibly, incredibly broad and incredibly rich. Not only that, it's amazingly accurate. So since the 1920s when it was discovered, thousands upon thousands of experiments have been done in quantum physics, and every single one of them has agreed with quantum physics. So it's incredibly well battle-tested. And not only that, the degree of accuracy and agreement with experiment is unprecedented in any theory in science beforehand. And it predicts some properties of nature, some of electrons, for example, down to within, you know, one part in 100 billion. So it's amazingly accurate. Also, you know, those kind of sort of fundamental reasons aside, it's incredibly practical. And the computer over there, your cell phone, your iPod, basically pretty much any electronic gadget that you use fundamentally is a quantum gadget. Because if you look close, deep inside it, and the basic kind of components and electronic circuits that make them up, they fundamentally operate on the laws of quantum physics. You can't use the old physics of Isaac Newton and others to understand them. And in terms of the economic impact, that amounts to billions and billions of dollars within Canada alone. So it's incredibly, incredibly practical, and also incredibly, incredibly just useful as a kind of fundamental scientific theory, a scientific tool. So also, it's really revolutionary. It's a very radical theory that really, in many ways, turns science on its head like no other theory beforehand. And I'm going to talk about that and go into that during my talk. So much so that Niels Bohr, you can see the quote there, he won a Nobel Prize for quantum physics. He was one of the discoverers on it. He said, if you think you can talk about quantum theory, just another name for quantum physics, without feeling dizzy, you haven't understood the first thing about it. So to him, it was so out there, so kind of freaky, that just, you know, thinking about it makes your head spin, makes you feel lightheaded. Also, there are a number of unanswered questions, unsolved mysteries remaining about quantum physics. And one of them is a seemingly simple question: what is an electron? What is the true picture of what an electron is? You know, draw me a picture of what an electron is. And with those questions, I'd have to shrug my shoulders and say, I don't know. Of course, we have lots of ideas and lots of theories and models, and I'll talk about those a bit later in the talk. But this is something that, what is an electron that at the moment no one knows, no one knows the answer to. It's an unanswered question. So, and scientists have debated that and related questions, you know, for many decades since quantum mechanics really was discovered in the 1920s. And two people that really debated it most fiercely were Niels Bohr, and you recognize Albert Einstein there on the right. And for decades and decades, you know, probably about really up until Einstein's death from the 20s up until the, you know, early 1950s, they kind of fought and arm wrestled and went back and forth, really trying to argue about what quantum physics really meant. And in some ways, the stakes could not have been higher. In some ways, you know, they were two heavyweights kind of sort of battling for the nature of reality. Because, you know, quantum physics really, it is the theory of basically the fundamental building blocks of everything in the universe, everything in the physical universe. And so who was kind of the victor in that battle, so to speak, would have, you know, found out or defined what we think fundamentally of physical reality. So really, really deep, profound battle. So quantum physics, I think, to many people, you know, there's a perception of it being hard, and there's a cartoon I found here that I think sort of reinforces that, fits in with that. But, well, if quantum physics is hard, well, you know, maybe popular culture is not so hard. So what I've kind of found in one of the kind of the themes in my talks that comes up a few times is a number of ideas and things in popular culture, so books and movies, that are kind of a little bit like some things in quantum physics that maybe we can actually use as a springboard to help us get a little bit of an insight into quantum physics. So I'm going to explain an experiment and show you a video clip of it in about a minute from now. And it's an experiment that takes about 2 minutes to explain. So it's called the double slit experiment. I'm sure many of you have heard of that. It takes about 2 minutes to explain. You could explain it to a 10-year-old, but it was one of the battlegrounds that Einstein and Niels Bohr fought over. And if you understand this experiment deeply and understand all of its implications and all of its ins and outs at the quantum level, then to many people, you understand quantum physics. So 2 minutes to explain, a lifetime to understand. So I should say this clip does come from an educational video, so the title, The Challenge of Quantum Reality, that we produced earlier this year at Perimeter Institute. So I'll just play the clip now. It goes for about 1 minute.
Tennis balls are classical objects. Let's see what happens when we fire some at the barrier.
What happened?
Some of the balls went through the slit and left marks on the wall at certain spots.
Right.
The distribution of marks on the wall lines up with a single slit. If we open the slit to the right, a similar distribution builds up.
What if both slits are open?
Good question.
With both slits open, we get the same distribution we'd get if we did the experiment with one slit at a time, then combine the results.
Okay, so that's the end of the clip. The double slit experiment, as I said, for the two kind of slits or holes that we put in the front wall. And that's really the setup there. There's the wall with the two kind of holes or slits in it. And there's the back wall. There's a tennis ball launcher just to the right of the screen, which you can't see. And we just kind of fire 1,000 tennis balls, 2,000, whatever, and kind of see what sort of pattern they actually make when they hit. So, you know, it may not seem terribly exciting, but again, we're sort of taking a couple of steps and we're going to get to some cool quantum stuff in a second. And that is kind of the pattern or the distribution that tennis balls make. Not terribly surprising. It's really just two kind of concentration or patches of tennis balls hitting kind of in line with each of the slits. So what I'm going to do is, what if I replaced, took out the tennis ball launcher and I got some kind of machine that launched marbles instead? What, and I, you know, basically repeated the experiment. What would I see? Would I see the same kind of general type of pattern, or would I see something completely different? Well, it turns out that you basically see the same type of pattern there, and that, well, that's quite faint there. But what that is really just an image of basically, instead of the tennis balls hitting at various spots, the marbles hitting at two kind of particular kind of concentrations or lines in line with the slit there. So I think that's hopefully looking a little bit better for you now. But same kind of pattern as for the tennis balls, but with the marbles. Okay, let's go a little bit smaller. What if I did the same experiment, but with grains of sand? So, you know, very, very tiny. And I hope that grain of sand is making its way around the room now. So do it with grains of sand. You know, what would we see? Well, it turns out, so basically I get, again, some kind of device or gadget which kind of fires out somehow grains of sand. And of course, they're not going to make exactly the same kind of sized marks as tennis balls or marbles, because they're much smaller. But I'm just looking for the overall general sort of pattern, just the general shape of it. Well, it turns out that, again, they do make the same type of pattern. And well, that looks totally black, doesn't it? Well, honestly, if you believe me, if you trust me, it does, kind of if we go back, it does actually look like that, except, you know, they look at little sort of brown dots and circles there, instead of really the yellow ones that you see. So really going from tennis balls to marbles down to grains of sand, there's, well, there's not really, you know, same general type of shape, same type of pattern. Okay, I'm going to do one last experiment. And what I'm going to do is, let's do the same experiment, the double slit experiment, but let's take out the sand launcher and let's do it with electrons. Electrons, tiny, tiny, tiny subatomic particles. And let's actually kind of fire them, you know, at a barrier with two kind of slits in it, and then kind of see what kind of pattern they make. Will they make the same pattern as the sand and the marbles and the tennis balls? So it turns out this experiment has been done by a number of people, and I'll show you a clip from the actual experiment. Can we just have the lights down for us now, please?
Herman Badelein and his team at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln are performing the double slit experiment with electrons. It's the latest in a series of similar experiments dating back to the 1960s.
One of our goals was to be as close to the original thought experiments as we could possibly be.
The scale of the experiment is incredibly small. Each slit is only 100 nanometers wide. That's 1,000 times narrower than a strand of hair. The experiment takes place inside this metal tube with a super hot filament firing electrons at the slits. After passing through the double slit, electrons strike a detector screen, which produces these green dots.
Okay, so that's the experiment. And just to show it to you again, you can see the setup there. Basically, this long kind of metal tube. And as I said, a number of similar experiments have been done. This one was done earlier this year. And you can see that really, literally, it's just a piece of wire. Literally, it's a wire that they heated up to a couple of thousand degrees, and the electrons in that were boiled off, and they went kind of firing very, very quickly towards just a very small square that had very tiny slits etched into it. And that's then in the middle of the tube, and then down this end was just a detection screen. Now, you can't see electrons with the naked eye like you can see tennis balls, but really there was an amplifier there that basically amplified really fundamentally the electric signals from the electrons up to something that we could actually see, the green dots with our naked eye. So this is a real experiment I'm talking about. So what did they see? So let's go. Did they see the same pattern that that we got for the tennis balls? Perhaps. So what they did again, doing it with, you know, just like we fired thousands of tennis balls through, they fired thousands of electrons through. And what they found is one thing about their results is that each electron hit at a particular point, just like a tennis ball. So you can see basically the red arrow pointing toward a little dot. And that one dot, that kind of spot, is a localized area where one electron hit, just like a kind of a mini, tiny, miniature version of a tennis ball. So again, let's look at the accumulation after many electrons have hit, and I'll show you a clip of the results. So
the left image shows the electron striking the screen individually. The right image reveals a pattern that has built up over time. Incredibly, after a large number of electrons hit the detection screen one at a time, they still produce the same interference pattern.
Okay, so this is a result from a very, very similar experiment. They've got the same pattern. Maybe it was a bit hard to see there in the video. It was a little bit, but this is really the same pattern that you saw in the video right at the end, the same result that they got. And the first thing to know about it, it's completely different to the pattern of tennis balls. And the thing about it is there's this huge kind of stripe in the middle there, basically this vertical stripe where lots and lots of electrons hit. And then to the side of that, something you just do not get with the tennis balls is that there's this sort of gap, or that there's very, very few or none. No electrons hitting there. And then there's some more electrons, and then there's very few. There's kind of this sort of striped pattern of vertical stripes there. And when scientists first started to get results like these, you know, in the early days of quantum physics, they were very, very surprising. Because all of the physics beforehand, you know, before quantum physics, really electrons were thought of being as tiny, tiny miniature versions of tennis balls. So that we should have got exactly the same pattern that we got for the tennis balls, the two concentrations. So this was a very, very surprising result, or results like these were, you know, when they were first obtained in the early days in quantum physics. So it tells you that, you know, small is different. There's something strange going on at the quantum level. So, and as I said before, you know, this was one of the battlegrounds, you know, that Einstein and Bohr fought over. So let's kind of go into this a bit more deeply, and let's kind of sort of delve into a bit more deeply and see what we can find out about quantum physics. So first of all, I think for some people their reaction to this is, well, you know, so what? So electrons really are tiny, tiny miniature versions of tennis balls, but you're firing a whole bunch of them at the time. And we know electrons have an electric charge. Electrons can bounce off each other. Electrons can repel each other. So what you're seeing there is you're seeing, you know, two electrons kind of get near each other, then they repel each other and they bounce off. And somehow, you know, I don't know the details, but somehow that just makes them kind of clump towards the middle there, and then, you know, there's sort of a gap and clump just to the left of that, and that causes the concentrations in the stripes that you see. So we can explain this result if we think electrons are particles. So that's a common reaction. So that's a good thought. But we can actually test this, because it turns out they did another version of this experiment. And what they did was they were patient. They were very, very patient. And they basically fired one electron out of the launcher, and then they waited. And then they fired another electron out, and then they waited. And another one out, et cetera, et cetera. And they waited so much so that the gap between any two electrons was so big that none of the electrons could ever interact or repel or bounce off each other or touch each other in any way. The gap was just far too large. So what result did they see in that experiment, one electron at a time? Did they see the tennis ball pattern or basically what's called an interference pattern, the multi-stripe pattern that they saw before? So it's exactly the same one as before. Now, this is a really, really weird result. Now, might seem a bit esoteric, but physicists get very excited about this. And in fact, so much so that there's a magazine, a popular physics magazine called Physics World Magazine. And you may not think of physics experiments as being beautiful, but they had a competition, a survey, about what the most beautiful physics experiment was in history. And there was Galileo's supposed experiment of getting on top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropping heavy and light weights to see if they fall at the same time, Einstein's or Eddington's experiment of light bending around the sun, etc. And, you know, they're all in the mix. But the experiment that was deemed to be the most beautiful by the panel of Physics World readers was this experiment that you see before you now. And I think what that kind of speaks to is really the fact that hopefully I'll explain it in a couple of minutes, that it really is, when you kind of think about it, it really is a very, very strange, counterintuitive, bizarre result. So it's exactly the same pattern as before. So the weird thing about it is it's not the pattern with the tennis balls. And we can kind of maybe sort of focus on the weirdness by asking, how does each electron go through the slits? Because the thing is, you might think, well, you know, we see the electrons. We observe them as being little kind of localized particles. They always hit at one spot, another spot, another spot. So they're just like miniature versions of tennis balls. But if that's true, then what they're going to do is they're going to go through one slit at a time. But if each electron goes through one slit, so electron number one goes through the left slit, then it's just going to sort of basically end up kind of concentrating just in line with the left slit. Then maybe electron number two goes through the right slit, end up kind of basically there's going to be this big patch or kind of concentration in line with the right slit. But if we do that, you know, we keep on doing that, electron after electron, what we end up with is the same pattern that we had for the tennis balls. So which is not what we see. So whatever is happening, it's not a naive idea of one electron just going through one slit like a tennis ball is. So it's more subtle than that. It's kind of weirder. And strangely enough, how does each electron know where to land? Because in the tennis ball pattern, in principle, any electron could land at pretty much any location on the screen. Some are more likely than others. But here, there are spots where we don't find any electrons landing. How does each electron know to go to some spots and to avoid other spots? And it's not talking or communicating, we think, in any regular way to any of the other electrons, because there's this huge gap in between them. So it's kind of weird. So there's the concentrations in the areas where there are gaps. Now, I mean, it's so weird that if you got the same thing happen with tennis balls, you get a tennis ball launcher and you'd fire one tennis ball and you'd wait, you'd fire another one, and you'd wait, and you keep repeating this. And after you looked at the accumulation of pattern after a long couple of hours of this, you'd see something like that, this kind of crazy pattern of tennis balls, which just, you wouldn't expect that at all. Now, this kind of experiment, this is so kind of strange and so weird that there are some physicists have said that, well, what actually happens is that each electron actually kind of splits up into two and kind of goes through both slits at the same time and then kind of sort of interferes with itself and that recombines and somehow that produces the pattern of multi-stripes that you actually see. And the famous English physicist Paul Dirac, apparently when he used to start some of his courses on quantum physics at Cambridge, would start by holding up a piece of chalk and saying that in all of the physics that came before quantum physics, classical physics, you know, this piece of chalk is always in one place at one time. But in quantum physics, and then he would basically make this gesture of breaking the chalk, there are states of affairs where the chalk is actually in two places at the same time. So a number of people have believed that idea. So kind of, if you were to come up with kind of a quantum street sign that really would fit in with this, you'd kind of have something like this here. Now, has anyone seen the movie Angels and Demons or read the book by Dan Brown? Okay, so there's the quantum physicist in that. So the character, Victoria Vetra, her father was killed at the start of the novel, and she's helping Tom Hanks' character along. And in the novel, if you read it, actually Dan Brown says that she was actually looking at these kind of effects, these effects called superposition of sort of quantum objects being in two places at once, except she was actually looking at them in schools of tuna. So, which, you know, they just don't happen on that scale in schools of tuna. It's only really on kind of a fundamental, sort of basic, teeny tiny, ultra-microscopic scale, basically, unless there are very, very special situations. So I kind of have to give sort of Dan Brown an F for that and kind of fail him. So another thing, we see this rock here that's very, very precariously balanced. And I don't know how long it stood there. I think if you actually look very closely at the photo, there's a car park on the right. And so I think someone actually set that up, and maybe it stood there about 5 minutes, and then it toppled over. But at least for a while, it was very, very stable. And so this rock here, being very, very stable, well, I mean, not so stable, you know, very, very delicately, finely balanced. And kind of, to me anyway, there's some sort of, this sort of embodies some sort of the, some of the spirit of another idea in quantum physics. And that is this idea that you can imagine if you went over to kind of sort of look at the rock or you touch it or if you had something at its base, if you tried to move it in any way or just kind of put your finger on it, it's so delicately balanced that any attempt you do to do that would just topple it over. So we kind of find something a little bit like that in quantum physics. So, you know, do electrons go through both slits at the same time? Do they go through one slit? What the heck is going on in the double slit experiment? Well, you might think, well, this is science, so let's do another experiment. And what we can do is let's put cameras, so they're sort of little cameras there, next to each of the slits. And let's look at, basically, you know, have them running and take pictures or whatever, video cameras of the electrons as they're passing through to see actually how they do get through the slits. So let's kind of catch them in action. So scientists have done experiments like that, a number of experiments, and what they've found is that they always see an electron going through just one slit. So I said, you know, that couldn't happen before, but, I mean, this is a black and white, a definite result that they just go through one slit or the other slit. So, you know, like tennis balls, so that's not mysterious. But here's the rub. What they find when you actually stand back and, you know, you've let 1,000 of these electrons, you measure them and they go on through to the final detection screen, the final wall, what you see is that the pattern, the final pattern on the wall, it's completely different. So it's no longer the multi-striped pattern that you saw before. It's really the tennis ball pattern, two kind of blobs or concentrations of electrons in line with each of the slits. So it seems like the mere act of actually kind of looking at the electrons, of observing them, has fundamentally, in a very noticeable, a very obvious way, changed them and, you know, change their energy, which direction they're traveling, something like that, and has actually completely changed the pattern that we see. And what quantum physics tells us is no matter how careful, how precise, how delicate you are in trying to measure the electrons, any act of actually measuring the electrons, it's an experiment where you find out which slit they're going through, just completely messes up and screws up and alters a pattern totally. And this is the basis for something called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's sort of another way of thinking about it. So if you kind of think about that, it's a pretty radical idea. I mean, in all of the science before quantum physics, we do have this idea of this sort of passive observer, this outside observer, and I can get a test tube here, and I can measure the temperature or the pH level or whatever of any chemical inside, you know, there without, you know, in any kind of obvious, noticeable way, you know, affecting or changing, you know, what's inside, the temperature or the pH level or whatever. There's sort of this kind of division between, you know, the system that's you're observing and the observer. That, in some ways, you know, in a real serious way, kind of breaks down in quantum physics. And that, you know, any time you measure an electron or really look at an electron, you noticeably change it in some very obvious way. Now, this doesn't mean any kind of new agey thing or it's spirituality or consciousness. It's a physical effect, but it's a very real effect. And it's one way where quantum physics really radically, radically differs from really all of the science that came before it. So we kind of have these two ideas. There's sort of this idea, perhaps, you know, this weird idea that maybe electrons go through both slits at the same time, and they're so kind of fragile or sensitive, any kind of act of observing them or looking at them moves them or changes them in some really obvious, noticeable way. So where does that leave it? What are electrons? So I had the question before, what is an electron? So I said there were a number of ideas and a number of theories, so I'd like to look at some of them now and explore some of them now. So what I'd like to look at is start with, so has anyone seen the movie Sliding Doors? Okay, great. So a few other people besides me. But it starred Gwyneth Paltrow. It was around about the 1990s. But the tagline on the movie poster was, what if one split second sent your life in two completely different directions? And so in the movie, she was rushing to catch a train, and somehow magically the world split into two. And in one world, she just managed to get onto the train, and that set off one particular chain of events and set her life in one particular direction. And another world, she just missed getting the train. And that set off another chain of events, and her life went in a completely different direction. So the world kind of just divided into two. So strangely enough, even that idea of kind of the world splitting is believed by some serious physicists in quantum physics. So it's called the many worlds interpretation. And
the many worlds interpretation explains the double slit experiment by saying that parallel universes are being created all the time.
So in quantum mechanics, we have superposition of different states. And the many world interpretation says that all these different superposition of states are equally real.
The world literally splits into many copies, and so we only see one thing happening, but there are people in another parallel world who see another thing happening.
So that's the many worlds interpretation, computer animation of the double slit experiment. The electrons were little green particles. There was the launcher, the little gun-like thing that launched electrons out of that. And what that says is that, going back to here, that any time an electron is measured, it hits the detection screen, that it could be measured here, there, one of many, many places. And the entire universe splits into billions of copies, one for each possible location the electron could be measured at. And so that's the entire lab, all of the people in it, you know, the entire Earth, you, all your friends, the solar system, everything in the Milky Way galaxy, every other galaxy in the universe splits into multiple billions and billions of copies just because a single electron, this object that's much, much smaller than a grain of sand, was measured in an experiment. And there are a number of serious, respectable scientists that believe and advocate this many worlds interpretation. So even though it seems like science fiction, it is, well, a scientific theory at least. Now, we should say there are a number of serious, respectable physicists that think this idea is totally crazy. But two things about it. One thing it does say is that, you know, undoubtedly people, experiments, electrons are being measured all of the time, right as I'm speaking to you now. So if this theory is true, then what it's saying is you are actually splitting into multiple millions and millions of parallel copies of yourself, kind of duplicating or spawning into lots and lots of parallel universes. Does anyone feel like that's happening to them now? Okay. Whether you believe it, it's crazy or not, I think one point to take out of it is that quantum physics was so bizarre and so weird that at least some scientists felt compelled that the best way they could understand it was coming up with this seemingly crazy, bizarre science fiction idea of parallel universes. So that's kind of one idea, the many worlds interpretation. So that movie then does get at least a kind of the essence of that interpretation right. So for that, I give a B+ to Gwyneth. So another idea, and the movie I chose to attach with this is, anyone seen Total Recall with that? Okay, so it stars that very well-known quantum physicist Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so kind of the movie, it really starts with, he goes to this kind of like this sort of virtual reality company and gets these sort of supposed where they implant memories in you and you have these fantastic adventures and, you know, being a spy or a secret agent or something like that to, you know, spice up your everyday life. But somehow that goes wrong and he has memories of being a spy that didn't seem to be implanted or were they implanted. But kind of one of the key themes of that is really kind of this idea of what's real and what's not real is very, very murky, and it's not very sort of obvious at all where the reality lies. And there's one quote from the movie, and that is, "You are what you do. A man is defined by his actions, not by his memory." And that's kind of a little bit, to me at least, in the same sort of spirit as this interpretation, the Copenhagen interpretation, which is the next way of thinking about quantum physics and the double slit experiment. So I'll just play another clip now.
The Copenhagen interpretation says that we should focus only on the results of measurements in quantum experiments.
When an experimenter enters a lab and interacts with a quantum mechanical system, the Copenhagen interpretation says, don't ignore that interaction. It's a crucial piece of what's happening.
So that's the Copenhagen interpretation. And it's kind of hard to see, but you have kind of the electron launcher way down the bottom left corner there. Then there's sort of this kind of sort of fog, and what that represents is kind of really that. So Niels Bohr, for example, he was one of the big champions of this interpretation, and he was extremely passionate about it, and he convinced a lot of people to believe in it. And what he said is, you know, science is all about, it's about measurements, about what you can directly measure, you know, black and white observations. And in the standard double slit experiment, we see the electrons leaving the electron launcher, we make measurements of them at the detection screen right at the end of the experiment, and we don't make any measurements in between. So really, you should just focus on the start and the end of the experiment, and just focus on the real black and white tangible results, because that's what science is. And if you try and sort of guess or hypothesize about what's happening in the middle, you're really just kind of spinning your wheels. You really won't get anywhere because we don't make any measurements there. So that's not physics. That's not science. And so kind of what we tried to do was represent that by this kind of sort of fog of sort of cloud sort of in the middle there. So one thing about that is Einstein absolutely hated that idea. That for him, physics was really about this grand enterprise of trying to find out the ultimate nature of the physical reality, the world out there, and, you know, the mind of God, so to speak. And for him, that, you know, he said that, you know, he liked it so little. He said that, you know, if this was the way the world worked, then, you know, he'd rather quit physics and go off and become a tailor and do something else. So we have this real, real tension between these two giants of physics. So looking at the last interpretation, so the movie I chose was The Endless Summer, and so it's a surfing movie, a surfing classic, and for that there's I'll show you what the interpretation is. I'll actually go back and just show you there. So again, the Electron launcher, the double slit, and the detection screen.
The pilot wave interpretation says that electrons are real particles, like tiny, tiny tennis balls, guided by an unseen wave.
In this case, you can explain why the particle is only detected in one place behind the slits, because there's only one particle.
It's this pilot wave that tells the electron what to do. So the pilot wave mysteriously knows about everything, where everything is in the universe, and it feels whether or not there's a one slit or two slits, or one slit open or the other slit open. And it can somehow tell the electron about this and move it around and get it to go different places.
Okay, so that's a pilot wave interpretation. So the basic idea in that is that you have this, really the double slit, and you have the detection screen there. And there's this kind of this sort of ubiquitous wave everywhere, this sort of so-called pilot wave. And what that is kind of a little bit like, I mean, not totally dissimilar to a surfer on a wave, it kind of guides or pushes the particles along. So basically what it does is it kind of guides them sort of along its contours, so it ends up kind of clumping and sort of clustering actually in the middle there, in the places where that correspond to that kind of central concentration of particles of electrons hitting, and kind of sort of somehow pushes them away so they actually avoid going into where you see very, very few electrons. And then it kind of sort of clusters them next to the next cluster, and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the basic idea of the pilot wave interpretation. So I have these kind of three interpretations, these three theories. You know, which one of them is right? I think, well, let's do a test. Let's do an experiment. This is how we make progress in science. So it turns out that, you know, that's not possible. That every single experiment that you could possibly do, all of these interpretations predict exactly the same results for all experiments. Exactly the same results. So there's actually no possible way of actually distinguishing them. Now, some people have taken that and said, well, you know, this isn't science then. You know, it's, you know, you shouldn't really worry about, you know, which interpretation is right, which, you know, what really an electron is at this level, because you can't do any experiment that can test. And so we've been, you know, debating and kind of fighting over this for decades and decades, going back to Einstein, and in many ways sort of progress hasn't been made. Some has, and not as much as scientists would have hoped for. So, you know, some people say, you know, you shouldn't even, you know, be arguing over interpretations. So this is huge debate over how to kind of figure out what the ultimate nature of quantum reality is. And there's this second debate about whether we should even be having a debate. So it's a little bit messy, it's a little bit complicated. And kind of tied up with that idea, we shouldn't be having a debate, there are some physicists that believe that what you should do is you shouldn't kind of worry about trying to get pictures of the way the quantum world works. What you should do is just focus on the mathematics, because that's one thing, the mathematical equations, really the laws of quantum physics, exquisitely and perfectly predict very, very well and incredibly accurately the world, and are used again and again to work very, very well. So that you should just focus on those. Don't worry about these, you know, these metaphysical, idle sort of debates and questions about what really an electron is. And so the technical name for that interpretation is the shut up and calculate interpretation. So it's a bit of a mess here. You know, we have this sort of this grand debate that, you know, questions like what is an electron? Or even what is a proton? What is a neutron? What is an atom? What is sort of any subatomic particle? We don't have an agreed upon, you know, well-defined consensus picture for what that is. So it's very, very, you know, it's very, very messy. In spite of all the amazing progress and technological applications of quantum physics, we fundamentally do not know really what these objects are. And because these objects, remember, these are the building blocks of the universe. These are the building blocks of everything we can see in the universe. So in a sense, we don't know fundamentally what sort of underpins and makes up our universe. So it's a little bit like living in a house, but really not knowing what the foundations is made of. But this house is fantastic, and it's really nice and warm in winter and cool in summer, and it's great. But this is really, it's this sort of nagging doubt and sort of worry at the heart of it. So, you know, it's a bit of a mess. You know, is there any hope? You know, is there any hope for any progress of getting anywhere? Well, the answer is maybe. So Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life trying to come up with a theory, kind of laws of physics that describe all of the forces known at the time. So a so-called unified field theory. So he fouled with that. He, you know, just did not succeed. But having said that, it was an incredibly, incredibly hard problem, really tough problem. And no one since has succeeded with that, coming up with a theory that we know to be, you know, empirically correct via experiment. And to many people, that is the holy grail of physics, or at least one of the holy grails anyway. And that would be a theory. So, well, there are four forces in nature, and there's gravity, and there's electricity and magnetism, which we kind of bundle up into one force, the electromagnetic force. And there are two very short-range forces inside the nucleus of atoms. And there's the strong force and the weak force. And on the one hand, gravity is described very, very well by Einstein's theory of relativity, general relativity. So it works perfectly for that. And the other three forces are described very well by quantum physics. So there's electromagnetism, the strong force, and the weak force. So, but the problem is there's four forces and there's two theories. And that, you know, so there's really kind of a dividing line between the two incompatible types of physics. And so what physicists love, you know, what we love is nice, simple, unified, comprehensive theory. So we would love to be one kind of theory that actually encompasses all of the four fundamental forces of nature. And that would be a theory that involved gravity, and it would also involve quantum physics as well. So that would be a theory of quantum gravity. And so there are, you know, hundreds of people around the world that, you know, if not thousands of people, a number of them at Perimeter Institute, that are working on this now, trying to come up with this kind of theory of quantum gravity, this kind of, and if we do that, maybe, just maybe, I mean, that will be a theory of gravity that involves quantum physics. So maybe, just maybe, what that will do is that will give us a new perspective and a new insight into quantum physics. And that perspective and new insight will just mean that really one way of looking or interpreting quantum physics will just be so kind of compelling, so natural, so useful, and that will be the way we're meant to look at and actually picture electrons and all other subatomic particles. Now, it may not turn out to be that, but it's just a little kind of ray of hope there, and it maybe will be the pilot wave idea or the many worlds idea or the Copenhagen idea or some other idea that, you know, no one has ever thought of before. So quantum physics is weird. Quantum physics is crazy. You know, Einstein himself, you know, never fully came to terms with it throughout the course of his life, and he battled with Niels Bohr over it. And to some scientists, at least, it seems electrons do kind of take two paths, two routes through the double-slit experiment, as crazy as that seems. It also seems that quantum electrons so sensitive that any time you look at them, you observe them, you kind of mess them up or change them in some very obvious and noticeable way. We're still trying to understand what these really revolutionary radical ideas mean, what kind of picture of reality at the teeny tiny subatomic level is, and ultimately what the picture of the physical universe all around us is. Maybe, just possibly, there could be some ray of hope, you know, if someone comes up tomorrow or who knows when with the theory of quantum gravity. But certainly, at least, I think that, you know, we will always, at least for a certain time, you know, look up to quantum physics and be in awe of just its kind of beauty. Thank you.
Thanks, Damien. So we're going to bring a microphone into position here for questions from our audience, and we'll just ask you to make your way down the stairs to the mic. And I believe we'll start our first question off with Jennifer Dodd with some thoughts from our online audience.
Yes, I bring a question from Tatiana from Toronto. She has a pop culture question for you. How would you grade the quantum science in the documentary What the Bleep Do We Know?
F minus. So, is there any lower grade than that? Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of that. I saw that. I think that's all I can say.
Okay. A second question, Phil from Toronto would like to know, why is the pilot wave picture ignored in textbooks? Should it be taught? Not as the only way, but perhaps as an additional theory?
Yeah, so it is, I would think it'd be fair to say it is, a number of people think about it and give some weight to it. I think it'd be fair to say it's somewhat a minority picture, that, you know, the Copenhagen picture, at least until recently, was very much kind of the dominant way of looking and thinking about quantum physics. I think there were a number of reasons for that. One was that it was just very useful to kind of get on with physics and sort of, because most physicists, so-called working physicists, a lot of physicists, for example, are solid-state physicists, so looking at, the nature of materials and properties. And so, and they're not really, concerned with fundamental sort of deep questions. And so you could actually sort of get on with calculating and doing physics in that field and many other fields without kind of worrying and sort of getting bogged down with, what is, the real nature of reality, what's the correct way to interpret quantum physics. So I think that's one way. And also, I think there is a bit of evidence that that certainly there's sort of a lot of momentum and a lot of, from Niels Bohr and all these other supporters of the Copenhagen interpretation that really kind of pushed their ideas and convinced sort of a lot of people to believe that, and then a lot of people kind of followed on to that. So I think there are, some sociological reasons. I think anytime you have a problem in physics and, you don't know, what the answer is, definitely looking at things, just like, any problem in everyday life, looking at things from a fresh perspective, a different, multiple perspectives can be very useful. And there have been examples, Bell's theorem is one, I think fantastic example where that really was motivated by the pilot wave interpretation. It was a big advance in physics. So, I think it should be considered.
Question from our audience?
Yeah, my name is Ronnie, and my question is, the underlying principle of all forces, is it energy?
Well, the underlying principle
of all forces.
I guess what I'd say if you turn to say, the thing is, remember we have the four forces. If I look at the three forces described by quantum physics or quantum field theory, so electromagnetism, and then there's the strong force and the weak nuclear force. Yes. Definitely energy is a big part of that. I'd say, for most physicists, definitely in those three forces, you do have this idea of kind of messenger particles, force particles that kind of go from you to me, so to speak, that actually kind of transmit that force. So definitely this idea of messenger particles is very fundamental, and kind of sort of underlying that is the idea of fields, these kind of spread out sort of force fields is very fundamental. But then if we're looking at gravity, then, that's a very different idea. That's in general relativity. So I've got to go to that theory. And that theory, it's all about kind of geometry and sort of different shapes in space and time. So at the moment with our physics, because we have this divide of general relativity on the one hand and quantum physics on the other hand, it's hard to really give a one-off answer. But if we had a quantum theory of gravity, then, maybe I could give you a one-line answer.
Thank you.
And next question.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. My curiosity is about the double slit experiment. What initially prompted or inspired that experiment?
Good question. Why do that experiment? It doesn't seem like the most obvious experiment.
Because we didn't know much about quantum physics at all, right?
First I know of that being done was really early in the 1800s, about 1804 or something like that, by a guy called Thomas Young. And he wanted to know more about light. And so we actually got a sheet of paper or cardboard or something like that, and etched two very narrow slits in it, and then kind of streamed some sunlight through and actually did that. That's the first time I'm aware of that experiment being done. It's kind of weird, because you might say, why do we have to set up these slits and stuff like that? If we want to know what electrons are like, just look at them. you know, why bother with all these slits and stuff? But it turns out that it's not so simple, because we can't just, electrons are just so ridiculously small, we can't just look at them. We've got to invent kind of clever indirect experiments. And if you just did an experiment with one slit, you know, that, you know, really wouldn't be enough. So what's, you know, the next simplest thing above that? It's two slits. So maybe that, you know, gives some kind of a motivation. Another thing I'd say is that really in the physics before quantum physics, the pretty much everything that scientists looked at turns out to fit into two categories. One were waves, another one were particles. And that if you want to, and we weren't sort of really sure what light was or really what electrons were. And the double slit experiment is one way you can tell whether something is a wave or a particle, which two major categories it fits into.
So it's like photon and electron kind of fall in the same category.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next question.
Hi, my name is Alberto. The question I have is on the multiple worlds theory, when we see the patterns, so are we actually looking into alternate universes or worlds? Is that the interpretation, that we're taking pictures when we see the different patterns of what would be the other worlds?
Part of that, well, I guess two answers to that. Part of that, it depends is what you mean by us. So this is a real question of identity. Mm-hmm. And if there are billions of copies that look exactly like you, but they're in multiple parallel worlds, when you say you, do you mean all of the sum of combination of all of those, mm-hmm. or do you mean just one in one world? If you mean just one of those in one world, then we are always in one world. Certainly that's our perception. Like, I don't know about you, but I don't feel like I'm splitting up mm-hmm. into, you know, multiple worlds now. So we kind of, I mean, I think of it like a tree that's just branching out into more and more branches, and we're just following one kind of sort of branch or sort of root through that ever kind of branching structure. So really in that, I mean, with the branching that happens, it is, it basically just sort of branches out. We're only in one world, if you mean, you know, kind of me sort of as I'm speaking to you now.
Thank you.
Okay.
And next question.
Hi. In the double slit experiment, is it possible that the electrons, their direction was being affected by, not by other electrons in the experiment, but by electrons just in, like, oxygen molecules between the slit and the detector, or the atoms that make up the walls of the slit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't mention this, but pretty much they sucked in that tube. The reason, one of the reasons why it happened in tube, they'd say made a vacuum in there, and they basically sucked, you know, as much of the air and the oxygen molecules out. Because if they didn't do that, yeah, then electrons would bump into the oxygen molecules and they'd go off every which way. So they need to do that experiment in a vacuum. And pretty much all of these quantum experiments, they are, you know, very delicate. You need to either do them in a vacuum, or you need to cool them down to absolute zero or close to it. So yeah, you need to take a lot of very, you know, special care. Like, to do that experiment, it took them, you know, a team of three people, probably, you know, 4 or 5 months to do that.
Thanks.
And time for a few more questions.
Hi, my name's Warwick. I have a question about superposition and the collapsing of the wave. If we're looking at it, my understanding is that when we're observing it goes down to a collapse and it only chooses one of the slits. Is that correct?
Yeah, certainly in some interpretations of quantum physics, absolutely. That it sort of goes through both slits, and when you look at it, it collapses to just be a particle at one spot. So yes.
If it's a collapse, they've also proven that you can see one photon of light in many positions. But we're observing that one piece of light in many positions. So how is it that we can observe it at that time? Is it because that we're better at observing without impacting it, that it can be in many positions and we can see it?
I guess any time when people talk about observing something to be in two places at once or three places at once, it's never really a direct observation. It's always an inference. It's always we observe something else and say, uh-huh, we could only have seen that something else if, you know, the electron was in two places at one time. And so certainly, for some people in the double slit experiment, just the fact that you do get that pattern, that interference pattern of multiple stripes, which is completely different to what you see for the tennis balls. Some people say, well, you know, that is indirectly observing that electron was in two places at once, because the only way you can get that, to some people is from having electrons in two places at once. So it's, nature's tricky. Nature's really tricky. Like, if we try and kind of catch it out, you know, like Schrodinger's cat and see that dead and alive, we can't. We can, you know, just make these, we're just really fumbling indirectly around in the dark.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jules. My question was, how is it that we're stuck with, we don't know what an electron is, but then at the other hand, we can talk about, oh, possibly it's made of quarks and things like that. Like, so we're trying to break it down. Like, isn't that a contradiction? We're stuck with saying, what is it? And yet we're looking at, like, maybe that Large Hadron Collider could give us some information about whether there are quarks and they're made, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's a bit of a tension there. So one thing, electrons, as far as we know, they are fundamental particles. They're not made up of anything else. Protons and neutrons, each of those seems to be made, you know, the current, you know, theory is each of three quarks. The thing is, we don't know what quarks are made of, or, fundamentally. I mean, it is strange. We can, we can do all these great experiments, and we can make further progress without, and it's really because the mathematics that we have is just so amazing, and the theories that we have, the tools that we have, we can kind of predict the results of experiment, we can kind of turn the handle, so to speak. It seems weird that we can do so well, we can build the LHC without really knowing, getting a picture of what's going on, but, you know, we can because the mathematics and the tools we have are so good. So some people would say, well, that's evidence that, you know, this whole debate about trying to get a picture of an electron, that's a very naive idea that may work, you know, in everyday scale and that kind of physics. But we're talking about subatomic physics, and that's a whole new ballgame. And our minds, it's so weird, our minds just aren't evolutionarily adapted to understand it. And we've kind of give up on this naive idea of trying to get pictures of what's going on, and we just have to fall back with the mathematics. So it's another idea.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Aaron. I was just wondering, you mentioned that there are four fundamental forces. Yeah. How do you know that there aren't any more?
How do we know? Good question. We don't. For a while, people thought a number of decades ago there might have been a fifth force that kind of modified gravity. You know, people have done tests on that, and there doesn't seem to be one, or if there is one, it's only a very, very small departure from gravity. The way the game of science works is we do, you know, as many experiments as we can, we come up with the best theories, we test them, we fight over them, we argue over them, and we have these provisional theories and you know, as far as we know, the best, you know, the smartest minds are being come out, there are four forces, there might be 25 forces, there might be one force, you know, who knows. But certainly this idea of having four forces is very useful. And maybe at very, very high energies, and also going back to the very, very early universe, maybe there just was one fundamental force. You know, that's an idea that kind of broke up into, you know, four different aspects of it.
All right, thank you.
Okay, time for one last question.
Hello. With the double slit experiment, didn't they not count the number of hits versus the number of electrons emitted? And wouldn't that explain whether it was the pilot wave theory or the multiple world theory?
Yeah, they didn't. I don't think they actually did that, because there are a number of electrons that actually get launched out from the really hot piece of wire. And actually, because the slits, they're really tiny, narrow slits in this, basically this sort of square. And so a lot of electrons actually basically don't go through them. They actually hit the side of it and they bounce off. So I don't think they actually, and to measure those, that would be very, very hard. And the detectors, you know, it's an experiment, so the detectors are never perfect. So I don't think they get an actual sort of count of the number of electrons in the experiment. But what they really are concerned about is the ones that go through the slits. They're the important ones, and the pattern they make, because they're really a representative sample of the electrons. And really, the pattern that they make tells you a lot about electrons.
Thank you. So in bringing this particular session to a close, If you enjoyed this introduction to quantum physics and the double slit experiment in particular and ideas on superposition, and if you've been challenged by this, then Damien and I would invite you to come to the Perimeter Institute website where you can see the complete video that the animations were drawn from called The Challenge of Quantum Reality, and you'll see Damien there on a freely available 30-minute video that examines all of these concepts in a lot of detail. So we invite you to come to the perimeterinstitute.ca, come to the outreach site, and look for The Challenge of Quantum Reality. And for educators across the country and beyond, there's also teacher notes there so that you can download this and use it in your classroom. Now, our next event begins at 1 p.m. EDT. It's a lecture with Craig Kaplan, a computer scientist at the University of Waterloo. In his lecture, Mathematical Art and Artistic Mathematicians, Dr. Kaplan will explore the exciting intersection between mathematics and art, so we hope you check that out online at the Q2C Festival online site. Don't forget to check out all of the other events going on in Waterloo this weekend on Q2CFestival.com. Thank you for those attending here at Perimeter Institute. Thank you for everybody online from home. That wraps up this presentation. The chapter's bookstore is now open at the back of the Perimeter Institute atrium. And finally, I'd like us to please acknowledge and thank Dr. Damien Pope for a wonderful introduction on quantum physics.